Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about the thousands of deactivated voter registrations in the city and what officials are doing about it. First, voters across the state on Tuesday will weigh in on a variety of races. The state Supreme Court race will be front and center, but some voters will also find school referenda on their ballots. And some of these decisions could have higher stakes than in previous years. That's because of a new measure that Governor Walker signed into law this month. It would allow low-spending school districts across the state to raise property taxes without getting voter approval. But districts that have had a failed referendum at any point in the past 3 years would be prevented from implementing the increases. That means that for a handful of districts in Wisconsin, a no vote on Tuesday would push them out of eligibility. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter and joins us from the Capitol now to talk more about what's at stake here. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
So let's step back, Laurel, for a moment and examine this rural school funding bill that the governor signed into law earlier this month. We touched a little bit on it there in the introduction, but what exactly does this bill do?
So this bill, which the governor signed in early March, would lift a state cap on what school districts can raise through property tax revenue. So this cap has been in place for a while now, and basically it holds property taxes and per pupil spending for schools to $9,100 per student. And if a school district wants to spend more than that, and to do so raise property taxes, they need to pass a referendum in their community. So the new law that the governor signed earlier this month raises that state cap from $9,100 gradually over time to about $9,800, I believe. So it would go from 91 to 94 and then so on for the next several years until it gets up to $9,800. And essentially what it does is it allows those low spending school districts to raise those property taxes without having to go to a referendum. So it gives them this automatic authorization. It gives them a state okay to go ahead and do that. And supporters have said that these low spending schools just are at a disadvantage. They're not competitive statewide. And so lifting this cap and giving them these automatic tax increases will help level the playing field for students that go to school all across Wisconsin.
And what do we mean by low spending school districts? What criteria do districts have to meet in order to be eligible under this bill?
Mm-hmm. So a low spending school district is a district that is spending less than that $9,100 a year per pupil. So when you you divide that up for the number of students that are in the district, if their number is at or below 9,100, they would qualify to get these automatic tax increases.
And so that's the bill, but there is that exception in the bill that would prevent some of the districts from implementing the automatic tax increases. Can you explain that a little more for us, if you could?
Mm-hmm. So this is where it gets a little bit sticky. So this bill, this proposal to lift the revenue limit, it's called, was something that was actually part of state budget negotiations. And it was something that the governor pushed back on during those negotiations because he was concerned about raising property taxes without voters' approval, having this automatic tax increase. And so when this bill came back into the legislative process after the budget was complete, it kind of became its own standalone thing instead of being part of the budget. Lawmakers introduced this new provision that said if communities have had a referendum to raise taxes in the last 3 years and voters have said, no, we don't want to raise taxes to spend more money for schools, they wouldn't be able to implement these automatic tax increases to raise the limit from 9,100 to 94 and so on. And the governor said that provided accountability that he was comfortable with. That made sure that there weren't communities that had said no to taxes recently and then would be subjected to tax increases against their will, basically because of this new state law, a decision that had been made in Madison.
We're talking with Laurel White. She's WPR's state capitol reporter, and we're looking at the impact of recently enacted legislation that would affect how school districts can raise money, or whether they can, through referenda. And Laurel, you said that if they've had a failed referendum in the past 3 years, they're not able to take advantage of raising property taxes. Mm-hmm. Do we know how many districts fall into that exception now?
So we know that there are 9 school districts that have had a failed referendum in the past 3 years. What's kind of interesting is that there's one school district in particular, and there's this loophole that's kind of interesting in the law. So the Howard Suamico School District had a failed referendum last year. So if you'll let me kind of carry out this scenario under the bill, they had a failed referendum last year, but they have a referendum again on the ballot this year. And they wrote into the law, lawmakers did, when they brought it back and added this provision about failed referenda, they said, you know, if a district has had a failed referenda in the past 3 years, but they try again, like Howard Suamico is going to do this year, and voters approve it, we'll forget that they have a failed referenda on their record, and their referenda will pass, they'll get whatever they're asking voters for, and they can take the automatic increases. So that's sort of lawmakers saying, you know, we're not going against the will of voters by automatically raising taxes, because they've come back and said, well, we voted no for referenda in the past, but now we're okay with it. So that's the position that the Howard Suamico School District is in on Tuesday, which is a particularly interesting one. They are currently not qualified to get the tax increases, but if their referendum passes on Tuesday, they will be able to get the tax increases. The other 8 districts that don't qualify because of a failed referenda in the past don't have a referendum on Tuesday. So they're just out of luck for now as far as those automatic tax increases go.
So if I'm understanding this, Laurel, the Howard Suamico School District either is going to basically get 2 hits or 2 strikes.
That's right. Okay. Exactly.
Wow. And so the others that have a referenda on the ballot on Tuesday, how many school districts besides the Howard Suamico have a referendum in front of their voters?
So there are 28 school districts with referenda on the ballot on Tuesday across the state. But 12 of those, aside from Howard Suamico, so 13 total, are those low spending schools with that $9,100 per pupil spending at that amount or below. And so those 13, including Howard Suamico, have a referendum on Tuesday. Now, that means they're in a kind of a sticky situation, right? Because they're in line to get the automatic tax increases. They meet the low spending school criteria. But if their referendum fails on Tuesday, they've got a failed referendum on their record, of course, so they will no longer qualify for those automatic tax increases. So they kind of, like you said, they're going to get a double hit. They not only don't get the money they're asking voters for in the referendum, but they don't get the automatic tax increases from the state. And in some cases, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars for the school that had come from those tax increases.
I'm guessing because it takes a while to get a referendum onto a ballot that this might be a function of kind of crossed wires, because I'm sure that those districts had to do a lot of advanced paperwork and filings to get those on the ballot. And then this bill was just signed in March. So those got on the ballot before they knew that this was going to be a higher stakes election.
Right, that's right. And so they're kind of in a complicated position. And this bill, I think, was just signed something like 2 weeks ago. So this is pretty new, and it does make things more complicated for them than they would have anticipated, certainly. Now they can do kind of what Howard Suamico is doing, and if their referendum fails this year and they're not eligible for the tax increases, they can always try again next year. But they would be missing out on a year of that funding from the state approved tax increase, which, as I mentioned, could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And obviously these are all schools that think they need more money, because they think they need more money enough to be asking voters for a referendum. So it would be especially hard for them to not only not get the referendum, but not get these tax increases too.
Well, and am I doing the math correctly that if they decided to pose another referendum next year, they would also risk resetting the clock back to 3 years instead of having been 1 year into that three-year waiting period?
Mm-hmm. That would be correct.
So, Laurel, the district officials that you spoke with that have these referenda on the ballot and you know, as we said, pretty high stakes, how are they feeling about it?
Well, I talked to the superintendent of the Howard Suamigo School District yesterday because I found their case to be particularly interesting that they have a chance to lift themselves out of this referendum ban, I guess you could call it, the three-year ban, to get the referendum money and the tax increase money. And he said that he's feeling optimistic. They've made some changes to what they're asking voters this year as opposed to what they asked them last year. There's a time period on the amount of money they're asking for. They're asking for $5.85 million over 5 years. So he thinks kind of having that five-year period is important to voters in the community. They've talked to the community a lot about it. But what's particularly interesting to me is I asked him, you know, do you think voters are aware of this sort of double whammy, high-stakes situation? And he said that he's tried to convey that, and the school district has certainly tried to convey that, but it is complicated. So it's hard to know whether voters really understand the stakes of what their decisions are going to be at the polls on Tuesday.
Well, Laurel, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about the high-stakes decisions facing several school districts across Wisconsin when voters head to the polls on Tuesday. Tuesday is Election Day. Are you registered to vote? You may not be, even if you think you are. According to Milwaukee city officials, thousands of Milwaukee voter registrations were deactivated in error, and it could have happened elsewhere in the state as well. The flaws are in connection with Wisconsin's enrollment in the Multi-State Electronic Registration Information Center, a program that checks the accuracy of voter registrations. In total, 44,000 registrations were deactivated. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joins us now to talk about the issue. Mayor Barrett, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my honor.
Can you tell us a bit about the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC? What is that exactly?
Sure, I'd be happy to tell you about it. And it really involves our work here locally. And this is done throughout the state of Wisconsin. So it's not something that's solely used in Milwaukee. But after every presidential election, the practice throughout the state is to go through the voting rolls and to remove from the voting rolls those individuals who have not voted for 4 years. That makes sense. It helps you keep the voting records as fresh as can be. Then there is a secondary one, which is called ERIC, and that's the one that you referred to, but we go by the acronym of ERIC, that is a multi-state effort to have states talk to each other so that you don't have duplications in different states, and also to use other data sources to make sure that people are living where they say they're living. So, for example, or specifically here in Wisconsin, two other sources that are used are the Motor Vehicle Department, the state DMV, and the U.S. Postal Service. The problem that we see in trying to double-check the records using those is we have seen that there have been a significant number of individuals who have not moved, but whose records have been dropped because, for the sake of conversation here, the DMV records don't jive exactly with our election records that we have. And to be even more specific, you may have a situation where someone's listed as 1756 North 20th Street, Apartment 3, on our records. If they're not listed as Apartment 3 on the DMV records, there's a chance that they may be dropped. This came to our attention when someone who actually works for our election commission realized that she had been dropped.
And so, like you said, this is a system that is providing an important service, but there are obviously some potential problems. Are these problems something that are faced every time there's one of these kind of cleaning up sessions of the databases?
Well, again, the four-year purge, as I'll call it, that's something we've been doing for a long time. ERIC is new. So the problem with ERIC, from our perspective here, is it's not ready for prime time, that we don't have the computers at the Department of Motor Vehicles that work well enough with our computers, and we don't have the information we received from the U.S. Postal Service working well enough with ours. And I don't want a situation where, and this is what we saw in February, we probably had over 100 people who came to the polls and they were told that your name has been dropped from the voting list. And that was a very low voter turnout election. Mm. So you multiply that by five or six for the spring election or the fall elections, that's going to cause problems. And so what the Elections Board has done, the Election Commission has done, is said, we will install or institute or provide a secondary list for the April election, for the election on Tuesday, and list all those individuals who have been dropped, so that the poll workers then, if you're dropped, may, if they're taught correctly, will go to that poll book for the secondary backup. My concern is that that's asking them a lot, and you're going to have longer lines if they have to go through a second list of voters. And you may have situations where individuals, and this happens to low-income people, it certainly is going to happen to students, because you're going to have students who are listed at their parents' address for their driver's license, but then might be voting on campus someplace, so that the two records don't jive. And I'm concerned about them. I'm concerned about, again, low-income people who move more often, that they're not going to be able to do it. And the response has been, well, they can just re-register at the polls. But if they don't have the proof of residence, then all of a sudden you're facing a situation where people who are eligible to vote, who have been on the poll, on the rolls, who haven't even moved, are told that they can't vote. And that, to me, is a problem, that we should be doing everything we can for people who are legitimate to make sure that they can vote, and not erecting these barriers. Again, I'm not claiming that this is nefarious, but I am claiming it's not ready for prime time, that until the state can satisfy us that people are not going to be denied the right to vote, I'm saying, well, let's delay implementation of that for this year, and let's make sure we get it done right before we go live with the system.
So you say it's not ready for prime time. Is this the first time, this February election that we had the primary, is that the first time that the ERIC system had been employed in addition to the usual four-year purge?
I think it is. I can't say that with 100% certainty, but it's certainly the first time where my elections board has said we have problems with this. So I think it is, to answer your question. Mm-hmm. But again, this is where we clearly saw problems in the February primary. And it's not just Milwaukee. I know other communities are facing similar challenges.
I wanted to go back to something you said, Mayor Barrett, because we do have same-day voter registration in Wisconsin. And now that we have the voter ID requirement, if someone went to the polls, had their driver's license or their state-issued ID, which they need now to vote in Wisconsin, is that enough to then go to, you know, maybe the table next to it and be able to register? Or are there other requirements that they would have to know in advance to bring things with?
Well, for the voting itself, of course, you have to have the photo ID now. To register, you, in essence, have to have proof of residency. Mm. And again, we're going to have people who show up on Tuesday who are not going to have proof of residency. If I were to say to you right now, prove your residency, it may be easy for you to do. It may not be easy for you to do, especially if you've moved in the recent past and your driver's license, which is the thing that I think most of us rely on, does not reflect your current address. Then you're scrambling. You're scrambling. Do I have a lease that I can bring? Do I have utility bills that will establish that? Most people I know do not walk around with their lease or with utility bills in their pockets that they can use to prove that they're live where they say they live. And again, that's fine if you know you're going to walk into the voting place and you have to register. But if you don't know that you're going to have to re-register, then it could cause a big problem. Again, I don't think it will for the April election, but I want to make sure that this is not used in August or in November elections, because I think it really has the potential to disenfranchise a significant number of people.
We're talking with Tom Barrett. He's mayor of Milwaukee, and we're talking about a purge of voter rolls that may have deactivated people who should have been still on the voting rolls and were not when they showed up to vote in February. And Mayor Barrett, how can city residents in Milwaukee, or residents anywhere, since this is a statewide system, how can they check to see if they are still registered before they go to the polls?
Well, I think in almost all communities, you can check with your village, your town, your city, to see if you are on the voting rolls. And out of an abundance of caution, you may want to do that, particularly if, again, you have a child who's in college or you've recently moved. Another scenario that we have seen is someone who may live in a community but may have a second piece of property where they register their car, maybe for auto insurance purposes. And so that address does not coincide with the address where the person actually resides. That could cause problems. So those are just several scenarios that could cause problems in a very practical way.
So contacting the clerk who would be in charge
exactly.
of the voting in your
exactly.
area is the best
yep.
route. And Mayor Barrett, you asked the Wisconsin Election Commission to just reactivate all of those affected registrations to make sure none of those people were caught up in that purge that shouldn't have been. What response did you receive?
I have not received a response yet. I also asked the governor to make sure that he was doing what he could. Again, we know for Tuesday's election that there will be this second list for people who have been dropped. I want to be assured that individuals have their address checked if they're on that second list. That's going to cause more time, and I don't know what the turnout's going to be on Tuesday. It's certainly going to be larger than it was in February, but November is when I'm really concerned because that's going to be a large turnout election, and I want to make sure that people who have the right to vote are not denied the right to vote.
Mayor Barrett, before we let you go, we spoke on the show earlier this week about a move by the Milwaukee Common Council to ban conversion therapy for children. That's a controversial therapy that is meant to change a child's sexual orientation. And we want to give you a chance to comment on that recent development.
Well, it was a lively debate, and I think it was a very genuine debate that occurred. I received several very touching messages from individuals who felt that they had been bullied, that they had been taunted as a young person because of their sexuality, and then may have faced the reality or the prospect that their family or someone else was going to put them into this therapy, and what a harrowing experience all of that was. And I think what we need to do is we need to, first of all, recognize the rights for families and their churches to counsel people. But I think the whole notion of some type of conversion therapy that is far more controversial is something that we want to give pause to here. And so there was, a very, I think, genuine debate that occurred. But at the end of the day, again, I think it's appropriate to have religious counseling or to have conversations. But this therapy is what I think raises a lot of eyebrows. So that's why we're concerned about it here in the city of Milwaukee.
Well, Mayor Barrett, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. He joined us to talk about the thousands of deactivated voter registrations in the city and what officials are doing about it. Baking is both an art and a science. You need to have the right ingredients, use them correctly, and monitor your baked goodies as they sit in the oven. And a lot of us might skip out on baking altogether for fear of getting it wrong. But our next guest says baking can not only be fun and rewarding, it can also be relatively stress-free. Erin Jean McDowell is a baker and the author of The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. Central Time host Rob Ferret spoke with her earlier this year.
Well, we've never met, Erin, but you start your book describing me exactly. Like, I feel comfortable with a lot of kinds of cooking. I know how I can wing it with different things, but not baking. I'm worried that it's so fussy that sometimes I just don't bother. And you tell me at the beginning, I can and should go bake right now. Why?
Absolutely. I totally understand why baking scares a lot of people, because there's not that same kind of fly by the seat of your pants
yeah.
vibe that cooking has, where you can kind of just add a little bit of this or a little of that. But if you understand kind of what's going on behind a recipe, suddenly it becomes much easier to kind of tweak your baking recipes, and baking can actually be very flexible.
And that's part of what I love about your book. You give some basics behind the processes, but in most of the recipes, you've got a why it works section. Why is it important for us to understand that why it works part of the recipe?
Oh, that's my favorite part of the whole book, every single why it works, because in those little tidbits, I'm basically explaining the science in just a sentence or two, not enough to bog you down and make you think, oh God, I have to understand chemistry to understand this recipe, but just enough to sort of say, oh, I couldn't replace sugar with honey in this case, and this is why.
Yeah, and you open the book actually with some stuff that answers some of my long-term baking questions. I do bake some stuff, and I find that sometimes when I put in, say, whole wheat flour instead of the all-purpose flour, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and there's properties of whole wheat flour that work differently. Can you talk about that just as an example?
Yes, absolutely. Well, different flours absorb moisture differently. So the biggest issue that a lot of people have is actually thinking that they can substitute a whole wheat flour for something like an all-purpose flour equally. Because the truth is, just because of the nature of having the bran and the germ inside the whole wheat flour when it's ground, it's going to absorb more moisture. It's going to need more to create a similar texture to something that was made with all-purpose flour. So you can use it, but you often need to make just like a couple quick adjustments. And the what I tell people at home now that it's more readily available in lots of grocery stores, there's something called whole wheat pastry flour. And that can actually be used as a pretty equal sub in many cases for all-purpose flour because it has a lower protein content. So it absorbs moisture a little bit more similarly to all-purpose.
And that's the first life lesson I'm going to take home from your book. Another basic tip that applies kind of across the board, you have a page on getting our ingredients to room temperature before we start baking. Why?
Well, when your ingredients are at room temperature, you're more easily to make basically an emulsion. So think about it a little bit like you're making a vinaigrette. When you make a vinaigrette, you know, you need to gradually add the oil in because the oil and the vinegar don't want to mix. Well, that same kind of thing can happen in baking. If you're mixing, just one example is a lot of people do use room temperature butter, but then they take their eggs right out of the fridge. And by adding cold eggs to a cookie dough that has warm butter, it's more likely to break the mixture. And basically, you're not going to have this kind of homogeneous, even dough. And it might still turn out okay, but a lot of times you can follow a recipe exactly and kind of skip that little step, and it can really make a big difference.
And how about softening that butter? I've learned the hard way that softening doesn't mean heat it to till it's liquid.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my favorite trick for softening butter, because I often forget myself even to leave some out on the counter, and this time of year, if it's really cold, it can take a long time. So I actually put it in the microwave, still in the wrapper of the, you know, the butter paper, and I put it in for 10 seconds and then turn it on its side and do another 5 seconds, and I usually find that that brings it perfectly to room temperature.
Talking to Erin Jean McDowell. Her new book is The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. We've got a few of your recipes that you've shared with us on WPR.org/Food Friday. This one is from your home state of Kansas, I understand, sweet corn cakes.
Yes.
Tell us about the end product. I'm not sure what I'm visualizing here.
So I love cornbread, and there's not actually any savory recipes in my book, and I actually get into a fight sometimes because when I was growing up, my mom liked to make cornbread a little bit on the sweeter side. She would have some sugar in it, and she would also serve it with honey, which was my favorite thing as a kid. We would have that with chili or all sorts of different kinds of things. And I would serve that to some of my friends once I moved away from home. And I had several friends who said, oh, well, cornbread shouldn't be sweet. So by calling it a corn cake, then there's that understanding that it's going to be sweet. And then I do that same thing that my mom did, which is drizzle honey over it. And in Kansas in the summer, the corn is just so sweet. To me, it tastes like candy. And it's something that I love so much. And so I sort of love using it in a dessert instead of kind of just buttering it and eating it on its own, which is, of course, also delicious.
The knock on cornbread is that some people think it's usually too dry. Do you get around that in your sweet corn cakes?
That's definitely not an issue here because actually sugar is a liquefier, which means when you're adding sugar to a recipe, it's helping to moisten the overall recipe, and it also helps to keep it from drying out kind of over time. If you make it and you don't eat it the same day that you bake it, if you keep it wrapped in an airtight container, sugar is actually going to kind of prolong the life of the baked good. So the fact that these are cakes and have a little bit more sugar than a standard cornbread, they're definitely nice and moist and really delicious.
And this is basically a quick bread, right? It's not a yeast thing.
Yes, absolutely. And so they're, I bake them sometimes in, you know, in muffin pans and make them kind of individual cakes, but you could also bake it in a loaf pan. You could bake it in a round cake pan. That's another way that I like to tell people that baking is flexible. If you sort of understand a little bit about your end goal, you can kind of make those changes and substitutions, whether you just don't have a piece of equipment or whether you want to make them individual rather than a big size. That's an easy change that you can make with a little bit of planning.
Now, you've got some corn kernels in this, and then you say polenta or very coarse yellow cornmeal? How do we make sure we get the right kind of cornmeal for this?
I actually did test this recipe as well with a finer cornmeal, so it will still work just fine, but I sort of like the texture that that polenta gives. It's coarser ground, so you get a little bit more of that kind of nuttiness that is in cornmeal and specifically in polenta. And then I like the corn kernels just to add that actual kind of candy bit, that part that reminds me of summer at home.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Cheryl on the line in Berlin. Cheryl, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Cheryl?
Well, I've been baking for many years, love to bake. My problem is my homemade cakes, they're delicious, but they're always dry, really dry. And, you know, I've added sour cream and stuff, and I don't know, what is the secret to it? And well, they're, like, heavy, too.
Okay, that could be a couple of things. And for one, it could be the type of cake that you're making. And even though it tastes good, it gets a little bit drier because of the actual ratios of the ingredients. It is a common issue I just mentioned. As much as we sort of all try to not add too much sugar unnecessarily, adding enough sugar is actually something that's really important to keeping the cake being moist, especially after a day or a couple of days. But also, it sounds to me like the problem could be slightly over-baking the cake, just a smidge, because really just a couple extra minutes in the oven can be the difference between the cake being soft and moist and just have a lot of really great flavor and kind of starting to dry out a little unnecessarily.
So, Cheryl, a little more sugar, a little shorter baking time, and then just drive them over to the WPR studio, and we'll give you our feedback on that. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go now to Stephen on the line in Wauwatosa. Stephen, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I am about to make an attempt at a buttercream frosting, but I found so many different recipes and I don't know which one would work. And I was wondering if I could get some tips on buttercream.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of different kinds of buttercream, and they're all kind of have different end results and also slightly different varying levels of difficulty. So the easiest buttercream out there is called American buttercream, and this is a really simple combination of powdered sugar and butter, and then whatever kind of flavor you want. You would basically just combine that in your mixer with your paddle attachment, and you can even do it by hand by mixing vigorously with a silicone spatula or a wooden spoon. My favorite kind of buttercream is Italian buttercream. And the reason it's my favorite, it's a little bit more effort, but the texture is just much lighter than that American buttercream, and it's silky smooth. And the smoother your frosting is, the easier it actually is to get it to look nice on your cake as well. And that's something that I can't deny the power of. So I would highly recommend trying out Italian buttercream.
And so with buttercream, since there's different ways to make it, does that mean, Aaron, that we have a little wiggle room? It's going to be hard to get it too terribly wrong?
You know, buttercreams are relatively forgiving, and most recipes I find nowadays also provide really good visual cues, as well as saying, okay, well, you need to cook this for 2 minutes. It also says, and it should look like this. And so when you're making buttercream, I think if you keep an eye on those visual cues, but it is the one piece of advice I would say is that sometimes buttercreams about halfway through mixing, they start to look almost like they've curdled or they've broken. And that is very normal. It happens. And so you just have to keep mixing it and not be scared. That's where the fearless part comes in.
We're listening back to a conversation with Erin Jean McDowell. She's a baker and the author of The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. Are you a big baker? What's your favorite baked goodie to make at home? Do you have any baking suggestions? And if you're a little nervous about baking, what do you need to know to get over your fears? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And don't forget, you can find all of Erin's recipes that we're talking about over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're listening back to a Food Friday conversation about baking that host Rob Ferret had with Erin Jean McDowell. She's the author of The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. Do you enjoy baking? Have you had some baking disasters or maybe triumphs? And if you have any baking tips for your fellow listeners, especially those who may be more on the fearful than fearless side, we'd love to hear them. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And remember, you can find all of Erin's recipes that we're talking about over at WPR.org/Food Friday.
back to your calls now. Anissa is with us in Appleton. Anissa, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Anissa?
Yeah, so I have been baking for, you know, quite a few years now, and I kind of come up with a really bad situation whenever I try to bake cakes. They're not light and fluffy. They're pretty dense, more like a muffin, which is, well, great when I'm baking muffins. So I was wondering, do you sift the flour before measuring, or do you measure before you sift the flour, or do you not have to sift flour at all?
That's a great question, and there's sort of a few portions to my answer. So the first thing is, when you're baking, the most accurate way to bake is by measuring by weight. And I know that that is something right there, right off the bat, that scares a lot of people. But what I remind people is, by measuring by weight and using a scale, you don't have to dirty all those little cups and teaspoons. So there's actually less dishes to wash in the end. So there's a plus there. But when you are measuring in a volume measurement, like cup measurements, teaspoon measurements, the best thing to do with dry ingredients is to spoon them in, just using a regular, house spoon, any kind of spoon that you have in your kitchen, and then use kind of the handle of the spoon to level it off. Then from that point, you would sift that amount. That would be the best way to get the most accurate measurement when you're measuring by volume.
Hope that helps, Anissa. Before we go back to more callers, Aaron, I want to check out another one of the recipes you've shared with us, jammy hand pies. So
yes.
These are little pies. I got to say, making pie crust, that's one of those things that intimidates me. That sounds like a toughie.
I hear you. And, I used to make pies with my grandma growing up, and I love making pies, and I love teaching people how to make pies because they have this amazing light bulb moment the first time that they get it right. And the biggest thing that people do with pies is just overwork the dough. And it's they just get a little bit too enthusiastic about the mixing, and that's what makes a pie crust really tough. And that's something that is obviously less desirable when you want that really flaky, tender pie crust going on.
And butter or lard?
Butter all the way. I'm an all butter girl all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Your crust recipe is actually all butter, B-U-T-T-A-H, pie dough, right?
That's right, because I can't say the word butter without having a little bit of like a butter. I just get a little excited by it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Cheryl is with us in Wauwatosa. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do a lot of baking, and I've always wondered, is it okay when you want to cool something fast to set it outside to cool on a cold day, or does that add like more condensation to it, or does it damage the product in any way? And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Well, according to my research, Cheryl, like a cartoon character is likely to come along and steal it off the windowsill. But any other objections, Aaron?
Actually, cooling something outside isn't really a big issue. What I would say is probably better is to cool it in an area that has a draft, by a fan or by an open window. That's where that whole situation of the pie cooling on the windowsill comes from, because you sort of avoid it being too drastic of a temperature change. But the one thing I will recommend not doing is, do not attempt to cool something faster by putting it in the refrigerator. It will bring down the temperature of your refrigerator, which is no good for anything else in there. But also the humidity and the other factors of a refrigerator can definitely be negative towards your end result.
But in Wisconsin, a cold winter day, putting it on the back porch, is that going to cool it, I don't know, too fast somehow?
No,
freezing?
It shouldn't. In general, like I said, it's better to sort of cool it at a more, to lower the temperature a little bit more steadily. And so putting it shocking outside could be a big change. But definitely, if you're just want to throw it out there for 10 minutes to kind of speed up the cooling process, there's going to be no major effect there that's going to give you a super negative end result.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jeff with us in Baraboo. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've just started baking with my granddaughter, and we've been looking at the equipment, if you will. And cake pans seem to be more complicated than they should be. So the question is, what kind of metal, for example, aluminum, anodized aluminum, aluminized steel, and then light versus dark, non-stick, reflective. Is there a basic, a very basic but very reliable cake pan by metal, by color?
Yes, absolutely. So I usually recommend people use lighter cake pans in general because they just give you a little bit more consistent results. In general, the darker the pan, the more likely the baked good is also to get dark. So a lighter pan would be my preference. I will admit that I really like nonstick bakeware, especially cake pans, because it just gives you, even when you grease and prepare your cake pan properly, it sort of gives you that extra security that it's going to unmold. And I will even go so far as to say my favorite brand of cake pans kind of across the board is Nordic Ware. They have some that are nonstick and some that are not, if you prefer to go the non-nonstick route. But I really like their pans, and they almost always unmold perfect and clean for me every single time.
Jeff, thanks for calling. Good luck to you and your granddaughter on your baking project. We're talking to Erin Jean McDowell, author of The Fearless Baker. Back to your calls now. Andy is with us in Menominee. Andy, hi.
Hi. I had a comment on the type of pan. I know you just kind of covered some of that, but is glass different than steel?
What are you baking, Andy, if I can jump in?
Like a bar, like a seven-layer bar or something
like
that.
Okay, yum.
My mom always used steel. My wife uses glass. I tend to like the steel a little better and put more of a crust on it, it seemed like.
Yes, that can be true. The one situation with glass that I will say is I normally recommend glass pie pans actually for baking pies. The reason being that you can actually kind of look right at your pie and see if the underside is baked properly. But in general, I prefer the results from metal pans. I do occasionally, my mom actually uses a lot of glass pans. And so when I'm home visiting, I bake brownies and things in glass pans. And if you want that little bit of extra crust, you can definitely still get it in the glass pie pan. You may just want to extend the baking time by just a couple of minutes.
Andy, thanks a lot for calling. Good luck with your seven-layer bars. I want to touch on one more recipe you shared with us, a great one for Wisconsin Public Radio. Donuts, yeasted donuts.
Yes.
How do we make these? And we don't need a special, you just have it in deep oil. We don't need a special donut maker for these.
Nope, no special donut maker. In fact, this recipe actually originally came from my great-great-grandmother. It was given to me by my grandma on a recipe card, and I changed a couple of things about it, but the recipe was so good that I pretty much use it as is. And what it is special about this recipe is it does involve yeast, but it's very set it and forget it. You basically mix the dough the night before you want to make the donuts, and then you let it do a slow rise overnight in the refrigerator. So instead of having to worry about whether or not the yeast has risen properly, I promise when you wake up, the dough is going to be ready to go, and that's all it takes.
Let's talk about premeditation here a little, Erin, because, you know, with yeast, you've got to allow some time. We were talking earlier about getting stuff to room temperature. Baking, it does pay to think ahead at least a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, the biggest baking dilemmas that I address from people asking me questions on a day-to-day basis come as a result that they didn't read the recipe fully before they started. And there may just be that one little tidbit that, you know, will actually make your life easier by reading the whole thing, and you won't miss a step or skip a step. And also, planning ahead and baking, for me, just makes it more enjoyable. It makes it more fun. One of the pleasures of baked goods is that a lot of things can be made ahead. So instead of, you know, when you have a big dinner party and you have to cook the, you know, the dinner right before your guests come, with baking, you can often make the item that you want the whole day ahead and just really enjoy the process of it, and then get to reap the rewards.
Erin, you've baked a lot of different stuff, clearly. Is there a next frontier for you? Is there the next project that you're working toward?
I've got a lot of ideas, I have to say it, but the one thing I will say, there was a distinct lack of savory baked goods in my book, The Fearless Baker, and so I would love to tackle that because those are some of my favorite things to bake at home.
I've been into making bread pudding lately, but I make a pretty very vanilla bread pudding. Any ideas on getting that a little jazzier?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could kind of add a caramel component to it if you like that vanilla flavor. You could make a simple caramel sauce. There's one in the book. And you could try that and just kind of drizzle it in right before baking, and it would continue to sort of caramelize inside. You could use vanilla bean instead of vanilla extract. That's really just an absolute flavor punch. Or try whisking some cocoa powder into it to make kind of a deep chocolate bread pudding.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it. Love hearing everyone's questions.
Erin Jean McDowell is a baker and the author of The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. She joined us earlier this year for Food Friday to share some of her favorite baking recipes and to give us some tips. And you can go over to WPR.org/Food Friday to find some of her recipes, including yeast donuts, jammy hand pies, and sweet corn cakes. Join us tonight at 7 for the Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate. Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson moderate the debate between Michael Skrenak and Rebecca Dallet as they vie for a seat in the state's highest court. That's the Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate happening tonight at 7 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. When it comes to weird food mashups, we've seen a lot of stuff around the Central Time office, some on purpose, some not. But we learned this week about a new food concoction that really takes the cake, or should we say, takes the pie. A diner in Middleton, Wisconsin plans to introduce, get ready for this, pie tacos in April. Essentially, they're shells made out of pie crust with the pie filling inside of the shell. Producers Bill Martins and Chris Molina are fans of both tacos and pies, so you can imagine they're pretty excited. Bill, let's start with you. You actually live in that area, right? Are you going to be lining up to get those pie tacos?
So here's the deal. No one has ever eaten pie and said, gosh, I wish there was a better way.
It's true.
It's ever since pie was invented, it's been fine to have the triangular slice on the plate and eaten with a fork. No one's ever complained about that.
So you're saying this is a solution to a problem that never existed.
Right. It seems a little gimmicky. But I will say, when I first saw the pictures of this, I got to say, that looks really cool.
It looks pretty good.
I'm going to try it, but I'm not going to be first in line. Okay. And then I'll probably just go back to the regular slice.
All right. Point, counterpoint. Chris Molina.
Why stop there? I mean, I'm waiting for the ultimate Taco Bell tie-in where they bring out the dessert tacos and the quesadillas and the burritos. I mean, there's a whole empire of pie-related products here. Why stop at tacos?
So I'll say I've had a taco where the taco itself was woven bacon. So
wow.
I could see bacon with pecan pie filling inside.
Okay.
Just leaving you with that idea. Coming up next, it's a news from NPR and WPR. Stay with us here on Central Time.